My name is Timothy Burrell. I don't know what to say, really, about my youth other than it was a disaster zone. Just one mistake after another well into my 30s, but here I am. I survived. The thing that amazes me most is how my friends from back in the day kept putting up with me disappearing for 5 or 6 years at a time, then rolling back in and showing up at some party and yammering on about everything I'd seen and done, all of it very skeezy, then vanishing all over again on some other drug-fueled adventure. I'm embarrassed now. In 1987, a couple of years before I overdosed, I came back to Amherst for a Christmas party, and I didn't know that my friend Fred, my old roommate from college, started to record me as I talked about some things I'd gone through over the years. 6 months ago, 33 years after that night, he gave me the tape. I asked him why he'd made it, and he said everyone loved to listen to me back then because even though I was clearly nuts, I was so unpredictable, and their lives were allegedly so dry and average. And maybe part of it was thinking that I might not make it much longer. And Fred wanted a little piece of me he could remember. I listen to my voice on this tape now, and I'm sad about how completely hyperkinetic I sounded because of all my problems. But what really jumps out is that for a lot of years, it seems like I was attracting something really dark to myself again and again. Something that was beyond just addiction and self-destruction. But like I say, here I am.
My Grammy Joan was always like, why do you just want to drive a taxi? Why are you throwing away your education? I would have killed for an education like the one you had. I'd say, Grammy Joan, you want my mind to open up to new things and new cultures and understand the world? This is where it's at. The second ride I ever gave was to a drag queen from Nigeria who was on parole for counterfeiting $10 bills. I don't need a degree, you old bat. This was like in 73. I was driving for a yellow cab in D.C. I had a fare out at some, what do you call it, seminary out in the burbs. I drove this priest, this old priest, into Georgetown just after dark, kind of like an infirm kind of guy. So I let him out at this house on like K Street, and I drive off, and I do another half a shift. And my last fare of the night says, hey, I think maybe someone left a bag back here. And I recognize that the old guy, the old priest, left it there. Nobody had mentioned it before all night. It's just a paper bag with some like overnight stuff in it. And I'm like, oh, God. If Grammy Joan found out I let some old priest go off without his toothbrush, you know, she's gonna haunt me forever, right? She's not even dead yet. So I'm like, all right, Jesus, I'm gonna be good, you and me, buddy. I'm driving back to that house. It's like really late by this time, but I drive back to Georgetown. And what the hell? There's cops everywhere on the block. All these red lights. People are standing around. I go over to them. They're looking down these steps that go down, you know, between the houses, all the way down to M Street. This is really close to the Georgetown campus. And down there on the sidewalk, some guy was lying there face down in a pool of blood. They're all gathered around him down there doing some kind of evidence thing. But he is done, okay? And you could see the blood stains on the steps on the way down. And there's a broken window in the house where I dropped that priest off. This guy down below must have fell out of that window and went all the way down. We're talking like 100 stone steps here. And I find a cop and I say, look, I just came here to drop this bag off, okay? I dropped a priest off at this house tonight. That's not him, is it? But he gives me the brush off. And I see that there's some other body being put into the back of an ambulance. So there's two dead people. You know, this neighborhood, probably the worst thing that ever happened was somebody got a flat tire, right? So what the cop did was he took my card so they could call me and then, you know, get me back in for questioning if they needed to or something. So I go home. And there was like one news article about this a couple days after. It was so vague. And then 2 weeks later, my boss goes, hey, someone requested you go out to Georgetown and drive somebody to the airport. And I go, and it's that same house. It's that same house. The cop had given someone in there my card. So out comes this woman and her kid. And it's Chris McNeil. It's Chris McNeil, the actress. Totally awesome, right? And I have no idea what the deal was. I just took her to the airport. But something really big must have gone down in that house that no one ever knew about. That dead guy on the sidewalk was a priest, too. I didn't ask any questions. You know, I was cool. But, you know, I was driving along. I'm like, oh, I got to say something to her. I got to say something. It's Chris McNeil. So I was helping her get her trunk out at DCA. And I said, you know, I appreciate you requesting me. And she goes, oh, yeah, my assistant did that. She said you did a nice thing. And that was it. I got to talk to Chris McNeil at least. That's my big celebrity encounter. When did I stop driving cabs? It was the year I stopped driving. I was so messed up. I messed up to the point where getting arrested was a relief. Like, you know, put me in jail because at least I won't be sleeping inside a snow tire, you know. So I was living in Maine, in Orono. I was working for this company called Dixieland Cabs. It had two cars, a blue one and a red one, and I drove the blue one. So I'm driving for them. And I'm living in this group house with two deaf guys and this hot punk rock girl. I mean, this girl knew her music, man. If you asked her, hey, name every lineup change the Temptations ever had, you know, she just like rattle it off. So how hard did I try to marry her, right? And everybody's wasted all the time. You know, there's nobody in that house that had any sense. I mean, when I'm the voice of reason in a group house, you got real problems. So I got this dream fair. This woman just wanted to go out. She wanted to get driven like halfway across the state to see her relative. So I do that. It took all day. And I drive back. And I'm high. You know, it's just weed. But, it's that stuff totally messes up my sense of direction. And it gets dark and I wind up in this town, Chamberlain. Chamberlain's like Keltisville was real outpost, and I'm going all over. I'm driving around trying to figure out what Route 2 is so I can get the hell out of there, and I hear this sound like, and I look up and I see the sky like get orange off of the distance, and I think oh maybe some kind of like warehouse fire or like some kind of industrial explosion or something, or like real bad news. And you can hear the fire trucks like 30 seconds later. Like, so I'm in the center of town at this point. It's Friday night. There's nobody out. There's like four businesses in this burg. And I start to just crawl along because I'm watching the sky and I'm not feeling real good. I can't see any actual fire. I just see this glow, you know, like in a dream. And it's getting stronger. And as I'm creeping along, making turns, trying to find Route 2, I'm trying not to go in that direction. And there's more sirens. And finally, I just stop. I'm getting such a weird vibe. And there's some kind of old factory off to my left. And on my right, it's just a junkyard or something. There's like nobody around in it, but it's pretty well lit. And I look up through my window, and there's this girl. She's just walking along down this totally empty street. She's wearing a long dress. She's kind of coming toward me, and she's got blood all over her. I mean, it's all in her hair. It's all the way down the front. You know, she's like maybe 17 or 18. And she's walking like, you know, almost like she's just out, you know, and she knew where she was going. And she's coming from the general direction of, like, where that explosion was. So I get out of the cab, and I'm about to ask her if she needs help. But then, you know, she looks at me, and she's got these big, wide eyes. And she's got a scary look in them. Like, you know, if I came too close, she was going to do something really awful to me. And I get back in, and boom, I close the door, and I just let her go. I figure, you know, she might be in shock, but if she needs me, you know, I'll be right here waiting. I don't need that look. That's the look my cousin Dot gave me after we made out and I told her, oh, by the way, we're cousins. You know, this girl in the dress just gets smaller and smaller. And then, you know, she just goes out of sight. And what I remember, you know, God, more than anything, is she walked away like her shadow on the building off to her left, you know, projected against the building. It was like this big white side of a factory. And her shadow, because the light just stretched up and up this side. You know, I'll never forget that. Three times taller than she was. This little girl, you know, walking off. I never told anybody I saw her. You know, all that stuff they found out afterward. And yeah, I'm pretty sure that was Carrie White. And she was dead like maybe an hour later, right? Yeah, Chamberlain. I'll never go there again.
Tell Fred the band story.
Oh, God, the band. yeah. I was out in California for a couple of years. That was the band. Oh, God. The Lawn Stumps, okay? the lawn stumps. I don't know if you remember Paul Ponder. You know, he says, oh, come out to California, man. We need a bassist. So I go out. I hadn't picked up a bass in 5 years. I'm like, yeah, sure, whatever. It's four strings, no problem. And I walk into the first practice we had, and the drummer, this guy named Bennett, he's standing up behind the drums. He's playing the drums. He plays them standing up because he doesn't want to sit down. He thinks it's stupid. You know, he wants to be up like a, you know, like the guitar guy is up. So he's got the drums up on like milk crates. And Paul's like, oh, people are going to love this. You know, this was our big hook, right? We've got the drummer who doesn't sit down. You know, other bands are working on their songs 12 hours a day, and we're all stoked because this is our edge, right? So we had like 5 gigs. It was this little stretch of beach towns, whatever. And then when they were rehearsing, and Paul busts out this chord progression that's really cool, and he's adding some licks to it, and we're like, man, Paul, where did you come up with this? He says, I don't know, it just came to me. And I cook up these lyrics about some astronaut pining for his high school girlfriend. We slap him in there. And suddenly we have something. But, you know, Paul starts saying stuff like, you know, I don't know. I got a weird feeling about this. Like, you know, I don't really know how it came to me. We're just, you know, Paul, you had one good idea in your whole musical life. You know, let it breathe, dude. And we're playing this song for 3 months, you know, and Bennett's standing up behind the drums, and then, you know, the women are just eating it up because they've never seen anything this radical in their lives. This drummer who doesn't sit down. You know, and I'm just, you know, I'm sitting there playing the same exact bass line for every single song because I don't know what the hell I'm doing. And some guy comes up to me after a gig, and he goes, young man, I didn't know anyone else was into Fade Away and Radiate. I was like, what? Of course, Paul, that idiot, he'd accidentally stolen some Blondie song, and he was so embarrassed he didn't even want to do the band anymore. He was like terrified someone was going to find out he'd plagiarize, and it would be like the end for him. He was all like, oh God, how did it happen? Bam, end of the band, and I'm stuck in California. But the part that I remember is about Bennett. Like, he didn't have a car, and we were always having to pick him up from all over the place. He worked like 4 different jobs. So one night we have to drive out like 20 miles to this town, Antonio Bay, right on the coast. He's out there. He's doing some handyman work on this church sometimes. He's not even getting paid for it half the time because the priest there is a drunk, he says. We have to pick Bennett up from some like motel he's painting part-time, whatever. Pick him up, drive down to Eureka for a gig. And we stop at a payphone to call him for directions, and he says, guys, something weird is going on in town. You all should maybe not even come out here. And we go, what? And he says, well, there's this really weird fog that's everywhere. You know, you can't see more than 10 feet in front of you. But we need to do the gig, right? So we keep driving. And I look, like, off to the left. You can see over the water, like, what Bennett's talking about. It's this bizarre, like, fog bank on the bay. Like, really bright. And it's you know, when it's over land, it's like in patches all over the place. And we get like 200 yards into town, we're at a stoplight, and it's rolling in toward us across these train tracks, this bright blue like cloud fog. And as it's coming, the lights in the buildings in town are going out, like the moisture in it is like popping out all the power. We're like, whoa, this is not normal. And it rolls over the van, and in about 10 seconds, the engine cuts out. And we're sitting there in this intersection. We lose the headlights. We can't see anything. We are just screwed. So we sit there, and we sit there. And Paul tries the engine once in a while, and you know, there's no dice. There's nothing we can do but wait. And Paul's always nervous about everything. He's thinking that it's like some kind of chemical attack, some kind of terrorist thing. The color of the fog is so weird. So it gets real quiet. And then we hear, on the rear window of the van, but it's more like a clink, clink, clink. And we look back, but you can't see anything through that fog. And Stephen, who was our front guy, he starts to go for the latch, but Paul goes, "Don't open it!" Really scared. So Stephen stops and we wait. And then after like 30 seconds or so, here comes again, clink, clink, clink on the side of the van. And none of us does anything. We all have the same strange vibe that, like, if we open the door,
I don't know. You know, whoever's out there isn't asking for help. You know, they want something different. It's just got that like vibe to it. You know, the three of us were kind of sharing the same thought in that way, and it goes away. You know, and then a little bit later, the fog lifts, and that's it. We were like, yeah, maybe like a mile away from where Bennett was. So we get him. He comes out. It's like nothing ever really happened. But some people died in the fog that night. You know, they never really had an explanation for what it was.
Yeah, after my brother died, I had a pretty hard time. I got it in my head that, yeah, maybe I could be a roadie. You know, I knew a couple of people, and they hooked me up with this contractor. I got a few jobs up north. I did a little work for Tom Tom Club and, like, Great Kin, you know. But it dried up, and I was squatting in this old house in Toronto. And it was me and this guy, Cameron. He was a weird guy. He'd been homeless for, like, a year. And he was just kind of there when I showed up. He was pretty smart. He just he didn't want anything to do with anybody. That was his deal. So it's winter in Toronto. Didn't have a dime. And we just kind of didn't bother each other in the house. You know, half of it was burned. It was condemned. But we would go out once in a while. We would just go on these epic walks around Toronto. And literally not say anything. You know, he wasn't really into scoring or anything like that. He just wanted everyone to shut up. Like if someone tried to talk to him, he gave him the stink eye. He had these big, like, glassy eyes. It was like someone put a couple of eggs in a Mr. Potato Head. And then this one day we're on a bench, and these kids start messing with us. You know, nothing major, just, yeah, ha, 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 let's mess with the homeless dudes. It's real funny. And eventually they get tired, and they're walking away, and Cameron is holding his hands to his head like this. And he's kind of shaking. You know, he's kind of shaking like he's having a fit, and his nose is bleeding. And I'm like, dude, what's wrong? And then all three of the kids, they fall like that. Boom. Right on the street. All at the same time. You know, and they don't move. Teenage kids all at once. It was like invisible Lawrence Taylor or somebody dropped out of the sky and sacked them on Third and Long. You know. And Cameron's like, we have to get out of here. And that's how he talked. That's how calm he talked. So I'm like, okay. And that night, we're just sitting around in the dark. You know, we have no power in the house. And he says, I've always been able to do that with my mind. But it's agony. And I'm thinking, Cameron, if you can do that with your mind, you maybe want to knock out a couple of bank tellers so we can get us some money? And as soon as I had that thought, he says, like he heard it, he says out loud, that would be wrong. So I'm thinking he's crazy or psychic or both. There's some kind of mix going on there. And I don't bring it up again. And about a month later, I tell him, you know, meet me down at Eaton Center. Because there was some guy I met who was going to pay us to pull the copper wire out of some house down the road. I don't know, we had to talk about it. So I get there, I get to Eaton Center. I get to the food court. And I see Cameron, he's got his back to me, and some woman is lying there in the middle of the food court, and she's like twitching and vibrating. And I think, holy crap, he did it again. And right away, Cameron starts like running through the mall, takes off, and these two guys in suits are chasing him up the escalators of the mall. And I'm just watching him go up and up, and he's trying to get away so bad that he jumps over the side of the escalator. He's hanging there as it goes up. His feet are dangling like 60 feet in the air. Nothing but linoleum down below. And mall security is just standing there like, what? You know, they're waiting for him to fall. But you can see these two guys in suits, business suits, are still running up the escalators after him. And, you know, finally I start running up too. And when I get to the top, mall security is up there. But Cameron's gone. He is gone. You know, like vanished. And these guys too. You know, I walked all around looking for him, and he never came back to the house. So I always thought those suit guys had his number, you know, like they wanted him for something. You get a guy who can zap people with his mind, you know, someone's going to be making some serious money off that. Yeah, my brother Jack got killed. He got killed. It was about as bad as it gets. It was so wrong. I mean, that guy was my hero. He was hilarious. And he wanted to work with kids, man, his whole life. When he got out of college, just his whole life. Yeah, he was a total hound, but man, he loved kids. That's what he wanted to do. And they called my parents one night and said, yeah, there's been an incident up at the camp where he was working, and this insane, you know, crazy woman came along
and she killed a bunch of counselors for no reason. I mean, Jack was just lying there. And this woman, like, shoved an arrow up through his mattress. You know, she was hiding under the bed. You could not imagine anything worse. You know, it ended the family to me. And that was it for Grammy June, man. I swear, every bit of the nasty vinegar she'd been torturing us with for years, it just vanished overnight. And 81 years of loving the Jesus man went too. You know, she stopped going to services. You know, she was walking around saying stuff like, "Oh, it was all a trick. All a trick, the whole world. This whole world. Get us to love beautiful things and then gone. Our beautiful Jack is gone. No point to any of it." And right into the nursing home she goes. Boom. You know, done. And I got real wasted one night, like a month after Jack died. And I was like, I'm driving out there. You know, I didn't even know why. I just needed to see. You know, I was staying with my folks till they got back on their feet. So I drove out 40 miles, Camp Crystal Lake, the place was called. I get there like 10 o'clock at night, and there's still police tape everywhere, you know. But what they didn't do was cordon it off, you know, entirely, which I found out was because they kept having these sightings of like somebody else wandering around that area, some guy they thought might be related to it all somehow, I don't know. So they were keeping an eye on the camp, waiting to see if he might turn up. And they must not have been paying that much attention that night, because I just wandered in. You know, I parked my car way down the road, but I, you know, it was pretty easy. I just walked through the woods. And as soon as I got there and I saw all those cabins sitting there in the dark, something about that, you know, that was it for me. You know, I decided, yeah, you know what? Life is not for me. Yeah, I think I'm about done. Jack is gone. You know, there's no point to any of this. You know, so you know, I start going into the water. And my plan is to have a nice little swim, you know, and eventually I'll get tired and I'll go under. You know, that'll be the end, you know. Doesn't have to be a big thing. And the moon's nice and high above, and, you know, I'm just kind of floating there on my back. And I look up and I see somebody standing on the other bank, like far away, like some tall dude just watching me. And I give him a little wave, you know. Because I don't want to concern anybody. I don't want to bring anybody down. It's all good. I just want life to end. And it was only when I got like really tired and I started, you know, slipping, like going under a little bit and kind of struggling that I got like very conscious of what I was doing. And I looked at the bank again, and that guy, he'd waded into the water like 10 feet, like up to his knees. And I started waving at him for real, like, "Help me." But he didn't move. You know, he was wearing some kind of mask. And the last thought I had was, you know, that's death. It's not real. That's the figure of death. It's too late. He's here. He's coming for me. Yeah, I should stop struggling. It's done. But I was scared of him. And then, you know, I feel these hands on me and I'm being yanked back like real hard. It was a security guard. You know, he swam out and he saved me. And the man on the bank of the lake wasn't there anymore. He'd, like, gone back into the woods. You know, I wasn't making any sense. I was delirious. I was yelling, "Did you see him? Did you see him?" And the security guard was like, "Yeah, it's going to be all right. I saw him. I did."